Just in case you ever think that the Christian faith is irrelevant in a modern world, that here we are answering questions no one is asking with our horse and buggy church in a supersonic world, just remember the elephant in the room. Have you come across that bright wee poem, The Elephant in the Room? There's an elephant in the room. It is large and squatting, so it's hard to get around it. Yet we squeeze by with, how are you, and I'm fine, and a thousand other forms of trivial chatter. We talk about the weather, we talk about work, we talk about everything else except the elephant in the room. There's an elephant in the room. We all know it's there. We're thinking about the elephant as we talk together. It is constantly on our minds. For you see, it is a very large elephant. It has hurt us all. But we don't talk about the elephant in the room. Oh, please say its name. Oh, please say its name again. Oh, please let's talk about the elephant in the room. Can I say its name to you and not have you look away? For if I cannot, then you are leaving me alone in a room with an elephant. The bad stuff is the elephant in the room. The bad stuff in the world that people do, that people keep doing, that people have been doing since whenever, since the citizens of Edom came to laugh at the misery of broken Jerusalem, since they came to take advantage of the vulnerable refugee people of Israel fleeing conflict, desperate for help, succour, solidarity, and finding instead gloating opportunists, rubbing their hands in anticipation of how much money they were going to make out of the misery of those unfortunates, vulnerable and helpless. Sound familiar? That was then, 586 BC. Not much has changed. The bad stuff is ever with us. The elephant in the room that challenges our naive hopefulness, our optimism about the human condition and the perfectibility of humanity, you know, how good it will all be one day with just a few tweaks, some better economic conditions, nationalise this, privatise that, the constant repetition of high ideals. Once we have a Bill of Rights embedded in the legislation, etc., etc. And yet, for all that, still, the heartless ones, the cruel ones, the greedy, cynical ones gather to pick over the ruins of other people's lives, to take advantage of their need, exploit shamelessly those who actually need to be helped. No, it's still there. The elephant in the room, neatly defined as an important and obvious topic which everyone present is aware of, but which isn't discussed, as such discussion is considered to be uncomfortable. The bad stuff. The bad stuff people do, there's an important and obvious topic which everyone is aware of, but which isn't discussed, as such discussion is considered to be uncomfortable. The Bible hints at where it all starts, tells memorable stories of choices made, decisions taken, that set the wrecking ball in motion, unstoppable in its destructive force. Choices. You remember the first one, I'm sure. Stop, don't do it. Hey, Adam, gonna not do that. The future, existence, everything that is or will be, holds its breath, hangs in the balance. Stop, don't do it. There is anguish in the pleading voice. Please don't do it. Slowly, deliberately, with a thin, determined smile, the man reaches up and with one movement plucks the fruit, the forbidden fruit, and in an instant it begins. The first of oh so many disobediences. That means everything falls apart in a terrible, typical, predictively self-serving moment. Everything is spoiled, or so it seems. Of course, it's just a story. But it's our story. Let's face it, the Bible is pretty obsessed with the bad stuff, preoccupied with what it calls sin. Now, there's a word you don't hear very often, sin. Its pervasive reality, its destructive impact, how it spoils everything for everyone. In fact, if you believed the Bible, you'd think we had a real problem with the bad stuff people do, that this actually was the problem, our problem, yours and mine, this thing, this tendency, this reality the Bible calls sin. people laugh. Oh, come on, what's all the fuss? What's the problem? Is it really such a problem? Well, I think we all know it is. Don't just read the Bible, read the history books, read the newspaper. It would seem from the tales they tell that all is not well. There would seem to be an issue with what we might call sin, or you could call it evil, wickedness, depravity. You could call it corruption or violence or injustice. Call it what you like, but the history books, from start to finish, from Genghis Khan to Stalin, from Caligula to Pol Pot, from Mao to Bin Laden, the history books are one long, ghastly catalogue of, well, sin, I suppose. It's out there, like a smell that won't go away. The bad stuff people do, making a mess of things, making a mess of society, making a misery of lives. Underestimate it at your peril, dismiss it to your cost, pretend it doesn't matter, but in your guts you know it's real and it does matter. It would seem that if you want to get real about life, you have to admit it. What the Bible calls sin is out there, and what the Bible calls sin is in here. So maybe the Bible is right on the money when it dares to address this issue as the root cause of our crisis, the fundamental sickness that debilitates humanity. Sin is the human condition, the plague, the malaise that sickens the soul, spoils and disfigures, and robs people of their happiness. And if we want to move forward, if we want to grow, if we want to get real, we need to address that reality. The Old Testament describes it in three images, and the first of those is to see sin as rebellion. We maybe tend to think of doing bad stuff as the breaking of some abstract rule or regulation, an offence against some arbitrary code of ethics. Yet, actually, the Bible isn't concerned with rules so much as with relationships, with the one relationship that matters, the one that shapes and determines the nature of our existence, our relationship with God. And essentially, that was Adam's sin in the telling Genesis drama. Not that he crossed a moral line, transgressed some ethical boundary. It was that he acted against the will of God, deliberately, freely and wantonly rebelled against his Lord and his God, and established his own wants and his own will above the wishes of God. And when we start doing that, we put a profound question mark over everything. We threaten everything with disorder, chaos, anarchy, for the order and shape and completeness of everything depends on God being God, his will for us and for creation being upheld and honoured. And when men and women choose to break with that, disaster. So sin is no philosophical conundrum. It's profoundly interrelational. It's direct and deliberate rebellion. The second picture the Old Testament uses to enable us to understand the dangerous dynamic of this tendency to do bad stuff is that of turning away from the right road and choosing freely and deliberately to take the wrong road, and all the grim consequences of that. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned each one to his own way. And that way, we discover, lies trouble, chaos and misery. Not because God makes trouble or generates chaos. It's just that's what lies down the road. When we head off to do our own thing and choose the broad road that leads to destruction and not the narrow road of truth and integrity. And we all understand that dynamic. We've all stood at the crossroads and known that when push came to shove, we chose the easy road, even when all the time we knew it was the wrong road. It's a powerful theme, turning off the right road to take the wrong one. Powerful because we can all identify with its unsettling realism. Yep, that's me. I've been there. I've done that. And in the Old Testament, we find a third way of thinking about sin that gives the lie to our aspirations and reveals the shabbiness of our self-righteous protestations. Like an arrow flying towards a target that misses it by miles or simply falls short of it altogether, so our best efforts at goodness fall lamentably short of what is required, skew way off, way wide of the target, and force us to acknowledge that in terms of lives of holiness and compassion and service, in terms of our obligations as children of God, and even as human beings, if we think we can be good and upright and perfect, and that somehow we will achieve such a high standard of moral probity that we will be as good as we should be, or as high-minded and public-spirited and compassionate as we need to be, forget it. Of course, the arrow of our good intentions. Oops, there we go. Fallen short again. We're not there, not by a street. Believe it, it's the truth. And when we offer our blustered protestations about how, come on, hang on, I've never robbed a bank or murdered anybody. The truth is, sorry, but commendable though that be, that's not enough. Nowhere near enough. The Bible couldn't make it plainer. Sin is our problem. We are sinners by inclination and in practice. And we better get used to the verdict that is unavoidable and unanimous. We have a problem. This is our problem. The big grey elephant in the room. It's not academic, it's not abstract, but as real as the morning paper with its catalogue of human wickedness, page after page, littered with the wreckage of people's lives. As real as the mocking, taunting laughter of the Edomites gathered like vultures to pick over the shattered remnants of Israel's dignity and strip it to the bone. These real events, these terrible cruelties, remind us that yes, we are rebels, yes, we are heading up a cul-de-sac of willful disobedience, and indeed we fall way short of the required entry qualifications for the presence and glory of God. As the book says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And just in case we want to delude ourselves that none of this uncomfortable analysis is to do with us, it's all just the Old Testament obsession with holiness, we find that in the New Testament, sin is even more rigorously described, with Jesus highlighting not just the external expressions of sin, our corrupt actions and callous disregard of the needy, but reminding us of the internal dimensions, the secret private world of motivation of thought, the fact that neglecting our responsibility to our neighbour is as culpable as direct action against him. That what we think reveals our hypocrisy and our lust no less than what we do. The internal dialogue is as much under the scrutiny of the holy, piercing searchlight of God's truth as any outward manifestations of moral weakness. The bottom line, the top line, and all the lines in between, they all say the same. Sin is writ large on the human heart. There's a problem here in our hearts. And in spite of what we might try to do to minimise the reality persists. Comedians may make jokes, be blasé. Entrepreneurs may devote whole streets and cities to it, paint it over with propaganda, reclothe it as entertainment or just human nature. It's just a bit of fun. But actually, in the cold light of day, there is a problem. Social, international, psychological, relational, personal, spiritual. And maybe turns out that the Old Testament and the New Testament and the church are quite clued up as to what makes us tick and what stops us ticking. Maybe what we need is an analysis that takes seriously the root issues, the basic questions, the profoundest realities. You need to admit the symptoms if you're going to get help. You need to acknowledge there's a problem before you feel the need for a solution. The great cosmic drama, the story of salvation, the thrust and purpose of the Christian gospel is to urge people to come on, keep it real. Deal with the real questions that dog our spirits. And ascertain whether the love of God is big enough to deal with that elephant in the room. Whether the heart of God is wide enough to welcome and embrace sinners like us. The hymn offers the word of hope we need, announces the good news of the gospel. Not the labour of my hands can fulfil thy law's demands. Could my zeal no respite know? Could my tears forever flow? All for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. Nothing in my hand I bring. Simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace, foul I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. Thanks be to God for the gospel.